four sentences, and then you popcorned across the room to someone who looks like they're not paying attention. And so I was gonna, no, I'm not gonna do that to you guys today, we're gonna do it. But it keeps everybody on their toes, so maybe I will, maybe I'll keep you on your toes and threaten you with popcorn reading. But Exodus chapter 11, let's go there real quick. So Adonai said to Moshe, I am going to bring one more plague on Pharaoh and Egypt, and after that he will let you leave here. When he does let you go, he will throw you out completely. He's going to kick you out, basically. Now tell the people that every man is to ask his neighbor and everyone her neighbor for gold and silver jewelry. That's their back pay they're getting for being slaves and being unpaid for so long. And Adonai made the Egyptians favorably disposed toward the people. Moreover, Moshe was regarded by Pharaoh's servants and the people as a very great man in the land of Egypt. So Moshe said, here is what Adonai says. At about midnight, I will go into Egypt. So who's going into Egypt?
Yeah.
Yeah. And all the firstborn in the land of Egypt will die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh sitting on his throne to the firstborn of the slave girl at the handmill and all the firstborn of livestock. There will be a horrendous wailing throughout all the land of Egypt. You see, God is always a God of equal weights and measures. The last time we saw a horrendous wail in Egypt was when all the Israelites had to throw their babies into the Nile River. You see, he's equal weights and measures. There has never been another like it, and there will never be again. Not even the dog's growl will be heard against any of the people of Israel, neither against people nor against animals. And this way you will realize that Adonai distinguishes between the people of Mitzrayim and the people of Yisrael. All your servants will come down to me. They will prostrate themselves before me and say, get out, you and all your people who follow you. And after that, I will go out. And he went out from Pharaoh in the heat of anger. And Adonai said to Moshe, Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that still more of my wonders will be shown in the land of Mitzrayim. So Moshe and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, but Adonai made Pharaoh's heart hard, and he didn't let the people of Israel leave his land. Chapter 12. Adonai spoke to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Mitzrayim. He said, you are to begin your calendar with this month, the month of Aviv. It will be the first month of the year for you. Speak to all the assembly of Israel and say, on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb or a kid for his family, one per household, except that if the household is too small for a whole lamb or a kid, then he and his next door neighbor should share one, dividing it in proportion to the number of people, or the Hebrew there is actually nefeshot, which is souls, eating it. Your animal must be without defect, a male in its first year, and you may choose it from either the sheep or the goats. Now, this is the very first commandment, the very first mitzvah given to the people of Israel. Interesting. You were to keep it until the 14th day of the month, and then the entire assembly of the community of Israel will slaughter it at dusk. There you are to take some of the blood and smear it on the two sides and the top of the door frame of the entrance of your house, in which they eat it. Now, let's pause there, because if you are an Egyptian, do you have the ability to do this? You do. You can do it. Now, would you run the risk of looking like a fool if you do it?
Yeah.
To your neighbors?
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Your neighbor walks out, you know, to get his newspaper off the driveway, and there you look over and, wait a second. Jim has pledged allegiance to their God? So you are defying the Godhead of Pharaoh, our king? And then Jim is like, yeah, man, he ain't got nothing on this God, right? He ain't got nothing.
I'm out of here.
He's crushed every idol. He's crushed all of our economy. He's crushed all of our religion. Yeah, I'm pledging my allegiance to him, and I'm going to see what happens. I'm going to see if my son lives and your son dies. And in the morning, I might be out of here. I'm going to pack my stuff, and I might be out of here. So this might be a goodbye. But can you imagine? And they actually say that the mixed multitude that went out with Israel, the Egyptians and all the people from the nations that pledged their allegiance to the God of Israel, actually outnumbered the native-born Israelites.
Wow.
Interesting. Which, if you look at the modern Yeshua movement today,
yes,
we vastly outnumber native-born Jews. There's 2.2 billion Christians worldwide that pledge their allegiance to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in some way or fashion. And I think there's around 16 million Jews currently worldwide, if I'm not mistaken. But it's interesting. So they'll slaughter it thus. They're to take some of the blood. Okay, we read that. Verse 8, that night they are to eat the meat roasted in fire. They are to eat it with matzah and maror, which is like a bitter herb. Don't eat it raw or boiled, but roast it in the fire with its head, its lower parts of its legs and inner organs. Let nothing of it remain until morning. If any of it does remain, burn it up completely. Here is how you are to eat it: with your belt fastened and your shoes on your feet and your staff in your hand. You're ready to go, basically. You're to eat it in a hurry. It is Adonai's Pesach. Now, this is the only sacrifice that will be referred to in the possessive form that this is God's sacrifice. This is his sacrifice. All the other sacrifices are not described that way. For that night, I will pass through the land of Egypt. So who's passing through the land of Egypt?
Adonai.
Yeah, and you will kill all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both men and animals. And I will execute judgment on all the gods of Mitzrayim, on Egypt. For I am Hashem, Adonai. The blood will serve you as a oat. That's the idea of a sign, a miraculous sign, marking the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will Pesach you. I will pass over you. When I strike the land of Mitzrayim, the death blow will not strike you. So this will be the day for you to remember. Like a Zachron is the Hebrew there. It's a memorial. And celebrate as a festival to Adonai from generation to generation until Jesus nails it to the cross. And you are to from generation to generation as a Chag Olam. Now a Chag is like a celebration. This is where we get the Arabic word Hajj. It means to go around. To go around, to celebrate. Hajj. Now when Muslims make Hajj, they walk around the Kaaba. But Chag is the idea, and that's why we dance in a circle. Chag is like a celebration. It's the idea of going in a circle. So it's perpetual. There's no end to a circle. Now Olam, the Hebrew word Olam, is the idea of a horizon. Now, if you ever looked out and you've seen, especially at the beach, can you see the end of the horizon?
No.
If you start walking towards the horizon, will you ever get to the end of the horizon?
No,
you won't. That's the idea, the essence of a Olam. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on. There's no concept of an ending. And that's what he says. It's to be a Chag Olam. Verse 14. This will be a day. No, I read that. Verse 15. For 7 days you are to eat matzah. And on the first day, remove the leaven from your homes. For whoever eats chametz, which is a big dispute over like what is chametz exactly. But basically, it's like it could be yeast. It's something that you mix with water and it multiplies. So it's this exponential multiplication. And I want to formulate a teaching maybe for next year on what exactly chametz is. But even Judaism is split in like 6 different directions as to what chametz is. And so pray about it, research it, do what you think is best for your families. And we'll do a better job maybe next year of formulating a teaching on that and putting that out, what that is. But for whoever eats chametz from the first day to the 7th day is to be cut off from Israel. On the first and the 7th days, you are to have an assembly set aside for God. And on these days, no work is to be done except what each must do to prepare his food. So food prep is okay, in other words. You may do only that. You are to observe the festival of matzah. For on this very day, I brought your divisions out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you are to observe this day from generation to generation by perpetual regulation. From the evening of the 14th day of the month until the evening of the 21st day of the month, you are to eat matzah. And during those 7 days, no leaven is to be found in your houses. Whoever eats food with chametz in it is to be cut off from the community of Israel. It doesn't matter whether he is a foreigner or a citizen of the land of Israel. Eat nothing with chametz in it. Whether you live or wherever you live, eat chametz. So let's jump over to verse 29. At midnight, Adonai went through the land and he killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. From the firstborn of Pharaoh sitting on his throne to the firstborn of the prisoner in the dungeon and all the firstborn of the livestock. Pharaoh got up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a sa'aka gadola, a great cry, a wailing in Egypt, for there wasn't a single house without someone dead in it. He summoned Moshe and Aaron in the night and said, up and leave my people, both you and the people of Israel. Go, serve Adonai as you said. Take both your flocks and your herds as you said, and get out of here, but bless me too. The Egyptians pressed to send the people out of the land quickly because they said, otherwise we'll all be dead. So the people took their dough before it had become leavened and wrapped their kneading bowls in their clothes and on their shoulders. And the people of Israel had done what Moshe had said. And they asked the Egyptians to give them silver and gold and jewelry and clothing. And Adonai made the Egyptians so favorably disposed toward the people that they had let them have whatever they requested. And thus they plundered the Egyptians. The people of Israel traveled from Ramses to Sukkot, some 600,000 men on foot, not counting the children. A mixed crowd also went up with them. That's that mixed multitude, the non-Israelites, as well as livestock in large numbers, both flocks and herds. And they baked matzah loaves from the dough that they had brought out of Egypt, since it was unleavened, because they had been driven out of Egypt without time to prepare for themselves. So there it is. They're leaving, and the, you know, it's hard to cut the story short right there, but you know that many of you know the rest of the story. God seals their redemption by bringing them into the sea, and he drowns their pursuers in the sea, and that's where we get this prayer, the Mi Kamocha, in Exodus 15. And it's beautiful. If you've never seen the Mi Kamocha in our Torah scroll or a Torah scroll, definitely check it out. It's written in a way that resembles brickwork of a wall, because it's like God shored up the walls of the water like they were brick walls, like stone walls. That's how secure it was for us as we crossed through. So I want to switch gears now and fast forward about 1,500 years. So the people of Israel have been keeping Pesach year after year after year, keeping it a zakron through thick and thin, through exile and through restoration. And now we come to the year of the people of Israel being back in the land, but under Roman occupation. Now, Caiaphas is the high priest. We have a Sanhedrin. There's 70 people in the Sanhedrin. 65 of them are Sadducees, 5 are Pharisees. And as you may already know, Sadducees do not believe in the resurrection of the dead. Pharisees do. The Sadducees, by and large, are not waiting for a Messiah, don't even believe in a coming Messiah. The Pharisees do. So if anybody goes before the Sanhedrin and they believe in all of that, it's not going to go well with them, right? But go with me to John chapter 12 now. John chapter 12. Yeshua has been living and operating in the countryside and the land of Judea, up in the Galilee, performing miracles. He's amassed quite a following at this point. So far, he is the best candidate, most likely candidate for being Mashiach, except he keeps making this troubling claim to the religious leaders. And that troubling claim basically is, I am the Son of Man. I am the Son of God. I am the I Am. And that's troubling to a lot of religious leaders at that time. And we're going to see him make one of those claims here momentarily. In John 8, he makes one of those claims. But John 12, verse 12. The next day, the large crowd that had come for the festival heard that Yeshua was on his way into Yerushalayim. Let's pause, because Pesach is one of the three Shalosh Regalim, the pilgrimage feast, where you would go up to Jerusalem. Pesach is one of those days. So they took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Deliver us! Baruch haba b'shem Adonai. Blessed is he who comes in the name of Adonai, the King of Israel." So they're coronating him as king. Now I wholly believe that the people of Israel, the Jewish people right now in Jerusalem, and you got to imagine this, first of all, Jerusalem has tripled in its population just for this week. Can you imagine Dothan tripling in its population? What mayhem that would be. It'd be crazy. And the Roman soldiers have also, if not doubled, probably tripled their population in the presence of Jerusalem, because they know, Pilate knows, that if there's going to be a revolt in the land of Israel, it's going to happen at a holiday that is themed around redemption from slavery. And it's probably going to happen and start at the epicenter, which is Jerusalem. So they're watchful. They're waiting for something to happen. If any shenanigans are going to go down, it's going to happen this day. And we know about this rogue rabbi who's coming into town. So they call him the King of Israel. I think everybody here is expecting Yeshua to come up into the temple and be like, "I'm here. I'm Messiah. I'm the king. Let's do this. Let's start a war." Kind of like a Maccabean style revolt. But it goes a little bit differently, does it not? So after finding a donkey colt, Yeshua mounted it, just as the scriptures say, "Daughter of Zion, don't be afraid. Look, your king is coming, sitting lowly on a donkey." So his Talmudim, his disciples, did not understand this at first. But after Yeshua had been glorified, then they remembered that the Tanakh said about him, and that they had done this for him. The group that had been with him, when he called Eleazar out of the tomb and raised him from the dead, had been telling about it. So let's go over to chapter 13, verse 1. And it was just before the festival of Pesach. And Yeshua knew that the time had come for him to pass from this world into the Father. But let's pause. How many days before Pesach is he riding into the temple? 4 days. When we read Exodus, how many days are you prior to Pesach are you supposed to bring the lamb for inspection into your home?
4 days.
So yeah, God has acquired a lamb. He has purchased a lamb. And he's bringing it into his house for inspection by the religious leaders. You see what's going on here? So it was just before the festival of Pesach, and Yeshua knew that the time for him come for him to pass away from this world to the Father. Having loved his own people in the world, he loved them to the end. They were at supper, and the adversary had already put the desire to betray him into the heart of Yehuda ben Shimon from Kiriot. And I believe that Judas here was trying to force his hand, trying to forcibly start a rebellion. Yeshua was aware that the Father had put everything in his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he rose from the table, removed his outer garments, and wrapped a towel around his waist. Then he poured some water into a basin and began to wash the feet of his Talmudim and wipe them off with the towel wrapped around him. So he came to Shimon Kepha, Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" And Yeshua answered him, "You don't understand yet what I am doing. But in time, you will understand." "No," said Kepha, "you will never wash my feet." Yeshua answered him, "If I don't wash you, you have no share with me." "Lord," Shimon Kepha replied, "not only my feet, but my hands and my head as well." But Yeshua said to him, "A man who has had a bath doesn't need to wash except his feet. His body is already clean. And you people are clean, but not all of you." For he knew who was betraying him. And this is why he said, "Not all of you are clean." So after he had washed their feet, taken back his clothes, and returned to the table, he said to them, "Do you understand what I've done for you?" Let's pause here because sometimes we forget the story. We forget that Yeshua knows Judas is about to betray him. Does Yeshua wash Judas's feet?
Yes.
This sets the bar so high for us as humans. Now, when someone irritates us, offends us, you know, when someone steps on our toes or snuffs us, let me just say, I'm going to go on a limb here and say that you probably have never been sold and betrayed unto your death like Yeshua was. Right? Has anyone in here ever experienced that? Okay. So that automatically precludes, I mean, you're going to have to wash everybody's feet. There is no one exempt from that calling. It doesn't matter how many times they offend you. Yeshua had the foreknowledge that Judas was going to betray him and sell him out, and that he was going to suffer the most horrendous, torturous death known to man at that time, yet he still got down on his knees and washed his feet. Ooh, that sets the bar high for me. Suzanne, do you have a question?
Yeah. Because when it was asked in one of the Gospels by one of the disciples, "Oh Lord, it's not me, who is it?"
Yeah.
And he says, "The one who dips with me, he could have only been seated to the right of Yeshua, which is the honored seat, the honored guest."
Interesting.
And the banquet host, which would have been Yeshua, would have put
him. Mm. Interesting. Verse 13, "You call me Rabbi and Lord, and you are right because I am. Now if I, the Lord and Rabbi, have washed your feet, you also should wash each other's feet. For I have set an example so that you may do as I have done to you." Now this is where we do this, why we do this. Because Yeshua says, "I'm setting an example, do this." And I was in Uganda with Pastor John Swaga there, and he said, "Tell me, when do you guys do your foot washing?" And I was like, "We don't do foot washing." It threw me off, and he's like, "You don't?" And he took me to this verse, and he's like, "We're supposed to." And I was like, I think you're right. So we took it to the elders here, and we're like, "Well, maybe we should start doing foot washing." And ever since then, it has been one of the most powerful and impactful days that we have here. He says, "Yes, indeed, I tell you, a slave is not greater than his master, nor is an emissary greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." I think we're going to jump over to chapter 18. Turn with me over there. After Yeshua had said all this, he went out with his Talmudim across the stream that flows in the winter through the Vadi Kidron to a spot where there was a grove of trees called Gat Shemen, the olive press, the garden of the olive press. And Yeshua had often met there with his Talmudim. So Yehuda went there, taking with him a detachment of Roman soldiers and some temple guards provided by the head Kohanim and the Perushim, the Pharisees. They carried weapons, lanterns, and torches. Yeshua, who knew everything that was going to happen to him, went out and asked him, "Whom do you want?" "Yeshua from Nazareth," they answered. He said to them, "I am." Also standing with them was Yehuda, the one who was betraying him. And when he said, "I am," they went backward from him and fell to the ground. So he inquired of them once more, "Whom do you want?" "So if I'm the one," they said, "Yeshua of Nazareth." And he told, "I told you, I am," Yeshua answered. "So if I'm the one, only one you want, let these others go." This happened so that what he said might be fulfilled. "I have not lost one of those you gave me." Then Shimon Kepha, who had a sword, drew it and struck the slave of the Kohen Gadol, cutting off his right ear. And the slave's name was Melech, which means king. Yeshua said to Kepha, "Put your sword back in its scabbard. This is the cup of the Father that he has given me. Am I not to drink it?" In other words, this is, look, we're not starting a war. I have to come as the suffering servant first, and then I'll come with a sword. So the detachment of Roman soldiers and their captain, together with the temple guard of the Judeans, arrested Yeshua. They tied him up and they took him first to Anan, the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the Kohen Gadol that fateful year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Judeans that it would be good for one man to die on behalf of the people. Shimon, Kepha, and another Talmid followed Yeshua. The second Talmid was known to the Kohen Gadol, and he went with Yeshua into the courtyard of the Kohen Gadol. But Kepha stood outside by the gate. So the other Talmid, the one known to the Kohen Gadol, went back out and spoke to the woman on duty at the gate, then brought Kepha inside. The woman at the gate said to Kepha, "Aren't you another of that man's Talmudim?" He said, "No, I'm not." Now the slaves and the guards had lit a fire because it was cold, and they were standing around it warming themselves, and Kepha joined them and stood warming himself as well. The Kohen Gadol questioned Yeshua about his Talmudim and about what he taught. Yeshua answered, "I have spoken quite openly to everyone. I have always taught in a synagogue or in the temple where all the Jews meet together, and I have said nothing in secret. So why are you questioning me now? Question the one who's the ones who heard what I said to them. Look, they know what I said." And at these words, one of the guards standing by slapped Yeshua in the face and said, "This is how you talk to the Kohen Gadol." Yeshua answered him, "If I said something wrong, state publicly what was wrong. But if I was right, why are you hitting me?" So Anan sent him, still tied up, to Caiaphas, the Kohen Gadol. Meanwhile, Shimon Kepha was standing and warming himself. And they said to him, "Aren't you also one of his Talmudim?" And he denied it again, saying, "No, I am not." And one of the slaves of the Kohen Gadol, a relative of the man whose ear had been cut off, said, "Didn't I see you with him in the grove of trees?" Now, this is important that he be found in the grove of trees, because the last time we have a perfect biblical symmetry here. The last time we saw someone in a grove of trees, in a garden, was a man who brought sin into the world through his disobedience. Now we have a perfect bookend. We have a man in a garden through his obedience bringing life to the world. One of the slaves, so again, Kepha denied it. I'm on verse 28. And instantly a rooster crowed. And I did a teaching a couple years back on what that rooster really was. It wasn't a chicken, it wasn't a rooster. If you want that, let me know. I can email that to you. But they led Yeshua from Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. By now, it was early morning, and they did not enter the headquarters building because they didn't want to become ritually defiled and thus unable to eat the Pesach meal. Isn't that, you see where their priorities are? So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What charge are you bringing against this man?" They answered, "If he hadn't done something wrong, we wouldn't have brought him here to you." Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your own law." The Judeans replied, "We don't have legal power to put this man to death." This was so that what Yeshua had said about how he was going to die might be fulfilled. So Pilate went back into the headquarters, called Yeshua, and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Yeshua answered, "Are you asking this on your own, or have other people told you about me?" Pilate replied, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and head Kohanim have handed you over to me. What have you done?" Yeshua answered, "My kingship does not derive its authority from this world's order of things. If it did, my men would have fought to keep me from being arrested by the Judeans. But my kingship does not come from here. So then, Pilate said to him, you are a king after all. Yeshua answered, you say I am a king. The reason I have been born, the reason I have come into the world, is to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to me. Then Pilate asked him a question that's still being asked by everybody around in the world right now. What is truth? So having said this, Pilate went outside again to the Judeans and told them, I don't find any case against this man. However, you have a custom that at Passover I set one prisoner free. Do you want me to set free for you the king of the Jews? But they yelled back, no, not this man, but Bar-Abba. You see, Bar-Abba was a revolutionary. His name was actually Yeshua Bar-Abba. But the translators wanted to respect and maybe minimize confusion, and they removed the name Yeshua. It's still in some translations, but some manuscripts of the Greek there in John. Yeshua Bar-Abba, it means Yeshua, son of the Father. So they have a choice. Yeshua Bar-Abba, the revolutionary, the insurrectionist, who's going to violently take the kingdom by force, or Yeshua, son of the Father, the Prince of Peace, who's going to suffer first and atone for the sins of Israel and the whole world, and then bring in the kingdom that way. And they have a choice to make. And we, ladies and gentlemen, have that choice to make every day as well. Well, Pilate then took Yeshua and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted thorn branches into a crown and placed them down on his head. They put a purple robe on him and went up to him, saying over and over, Hail to the King of the Jews! And they began to hit him in the face. Pilate went outside once more and said to the crowd, Look, I'm bringing him out to you to get you to understand that I find no case against this man. So Yeshua came out, wearing the thorn branch crown and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, Look at the man. When the head Kohanim and the temple guards saw him, they shouted, Put him to death on a cross! Put him to death on the cross! Crucify him, in other words. Now, they were no strangers to crucifixion at that time. The Romans had been crucifying people for almost 100 years in the land of Judea at this point. When you were going up to one of the pilgrimage feasts, for miles leading up to the roads leading up to Jerusalem, on either side would have criminals hanging at different points of life, death, decomposition, perhaps animals, family members laying on the ground mourning the person hanging on that stake. This was a norm to you as you're walking up to Jerusalem. Maybe the kids having a look down at the ground, the smells you would smell, right? And the Romans did this. They said, if you want to come up to Jerusalem, that's fine. But don't mess with the Romans. This is what will happen to you. What verse am I in? Seven, thank you. Jim's paying attention. The Judeans answered him, We have a law. According to that law, he ought to be put to death because he made himself out to be the Son of God. And on hearing this, Pilate became even more frightened. He went back into the headquarters and asked Yeshua, Where are you from? But Yeshua didn't answer. So Pilate said to him, You refuse to speak to me? Don't you understand that it is in my power either to set you free or to have you executed on a stake? And Yeshua answered, You would have no power over me if it had not been given to you from above. This is why the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. On hearing this, Pilate tried to find a way to set him free. But the Judean shouted, If you set this man free, it means you're not a friend to the emperor. Everyone who claims to be king is opposing the emperor. When Pilate heard what they were saying, he brought Yeshua outside and sat down on one of the judges' seat in the place called the pavement, which is in Aramaic, the Gabta. It was about noon on preparation day for Pesach. So about, well, look at the clock, right now. He said to the Judeans, Here is your king. And they shouted, Take him away, take him away. Put him to death on a stake. And Pilate said to them, You want me to execute your king on a stake? The head Kohanim answered, We have no king but the emperor. Then Pilate handed Yeshua over to them to have him put to death on a stake. So they took charge of Yeshua. Carrying the stake himself, he went out to the place called in Aramaic Golgotha, where they nailed him to the stake along with the others, one on either side, with Yeshua in the middle. Pilate also had a notice written and posted on the stake as it read, Yeshua from Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And if you were to write that out in Hebrew, I've done it many times, the first word, the first letter of each of those words spells the Yud, and then Hey, and Vav, and then Hey. Many of the Judeans read this notice because the place where Yeshua was put on the stake was close to the city, and it had been written in Hebrew, in Latin, and in Greek. The Judeans' head Kohanim therefore said to Pilate, don't write the King of the Jews. But he said, I am the King. I am King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. When the soldiers had nailed Yeshua to the stake, they took his clothes and divided them into four shares, a share for each soldier, with the underrobe left over. Now the underrobe was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. So they said to one another, we shouldn't tear it in pieces. Let's draw lots for it. This happened in order to fulfill the words of the scriptures. They divided my clothes among themselves, and they gambled for my robes. And this is why the soldiers did these things. Nearby Yeshua's execution stake stood his mother, his mother's sister Miriam, the wife of Kelophah, and Miriam from Magdala. When Yeshua saw his mother and the Talmid whom he loved standing there, he said to his mother, mother, this is your son. And then he said to the Talmid, this is your mother. And from that time on, the Talmid took her into his own home. And after this, knowing that all things had accomplished their purpose, Yeshua, in order to fulfill the words of the Tanakh, said, I am thirsty. A jar of cheap sour wine was there. So they soaked a sponge in the wine, coated it with oregano leaves, and held it up to his mouth. And after Yeshua had taken the wine, he said, it is accomplished, or it is finished. And letting his head droop, he delivered up his spirit. It was preparation day, and the Judeans did not want the bodies to remain on the stake on Shabbat, since it was an especially important Shabbat. And a lot of people get confused here. It wasn't the weekly Shabbat. It was the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But some people get confused, and they think it's a weekly Shabbat, so therefore this crucifixion had to take place on a Friday, and therefore, you know, if he rose on the first day of the week, but the math is a little bit wrong. It's just a misunderstanding of how the first day of Unleavened Bread, it can fall any day of the week. It was likely a Thursday, so he was, you know, it's just a little bit confusing to some people who aren't familiar with the Moedim, the feast days. So they asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies removed. The soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man who had been put on the stake beside Yeshua, then the legs of the other one. But when they got to Yeshua and they saw that he was already dead, they didn't break his legs. Why is that important? Because the Passover lamb had to have no broken bones. However, one of the soldiers stabbed his side with a spear, and at once blood and water flowed out. The man who saw it has testified about it, and his testimony is true. And he knows that he tells the truth. So you too can trust, for these things have happened in order to fulfill the passage of the scriptures, that not one of his bones will be broken. And again, another passage says, they will look at him whom they have pierced. And after this, Yosef of Ramatayim, who was a Talmid of Yeshua, but a secret one out of fear of the Judeans, and he's also pretty good credible evidence points to the fact that he was one of the five Pharisees on the Sanhedrin. He asked Pilate if he could have Yeshua's body. Pilate gave his consent, so Yosef came and took the body away. Also, Nicodemus, who at first had gone to see Yeshua by night, came with some 70 pounds of spices, a mixture of myrrh and aloes, and they took Yeshua's body, and they wrapped it up in linen sheets with the spices in keeping with the Judean burial practice. Now, what they would do in the first century is they would put your body in a tomb, in like a cave hewn out of stone, and they would let your body decompose for about a year or two. And then the family would go in, they would collect your bones, and they would put your bones in a box called an ossuary. And then they would engrave your name on the ossuary and your family relations, and then they would put your ossuary on a shelf in a tomb. And so that, I believe that's what was destined for Yeshua's bones here. And we actually have, we know we have Caiaphas's ossuary, the high priest. It's a very, very ornate ossuary. And also there's been one found that says, James, the brother of Jesus, or Yaakov, it actually says Yaakov ben Yosef Achi Yeshua, the brother of Yeshua. But there's nothing in it. You know, the tomb raiders have long since emptied all those things. So early on the first day of the week, here's my favorite part. While it was still dark, Miriam from Magdala went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been rolled away. So she came running to Shimon Kefa, the first, remember he just denied him three times, right? Came running to Shimon Kefa and the other Talmid, the one Yeshua loved, and said to them, "They've taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they put him." Then Kefa and the other Talmidim started for the tomb. They both ran, but the other Talmid outran Kefa and reached the tomb first. Stooping down, he saw the linen burial sheets lying there, but did not go in. And then following him, Shimon Kefa arrived, entered the tomb. So he ran all the way into the tomb, and he saw the burial sheets lying there. Also the cloth that had been around his head, lying not with the sheets, but in a separate place, still folded up. Then the other Talmidim, or the other Talmid, who had arrived at the tomb first, also went in, and he saw, and he trusted. They had not yet come to understand that the scriptures teaches that the Messiah had to rise from the dead. So the Talmidim returned home, but Miriam stood outside crying. As she cried, she bent down, peered into the tomb, and saw two angels in white sitting there where the body of Yeshua had been, one at the head and one at the feet. "Why are you crying?" they asked her. "Because they took my Lord," she said to them, "and I don't know where they have put him." As she said this, she turned around, first person to see him. He was standing there, but she didn't know it was him. Yeshua said to her, "Lady, why are you crying? Whom are you looking for?" Thinking that he was a gardener. Who else was a gardener?
Adam.
Thinking he was a gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you're the one who carried him away, just tell me where you put him, and I'll go get him myself." Yeshua said to her, "Miriam." So turning, she cried out to him in Hebrew, "Rabbani," that is, "my teacher." "Stop holding on to me," Yeshua said to her, "because I haven't yet gone back to the Father. But go to my brothers and tell them that I am going back to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Miriam of Magdala went to the Talmidim with the news that she had seen the Lord, and he had told her this. So here we have Yeshua appearing to his Talmidim. He did not stay in the grave. He rose, praise God. And I believe one of the most cataclysmic, world-changing events in human history just transpired. And that'll happen 3 days from now. So I encourage you guys, as you gather with your families this evening, and you welcome in the feast, and you celebrate the feast, make it about two things. That God is a God who wants to redeem his people. And he will go to drastic measures to make that possible. And number two, remember. Remember the sacrifice Yeshua made for us, the death, the horrific torture that he went through. And may we teach our kids and our wives and our husbands and our families to live lives that are worthy of that dying for, worthy of that sacrifice. I had a girl yesterday on detention. She had an hour detention, and the principal comes in, pops in my classroom, and I'm sitting there putting grades in at the end of the day, and she says, "Do you need a sweeper?" And I didn't know who she was talking about. I was like, "Yeah, I guess I could use someone to sweep my classroom." And in comes this girl, and she looked real downcast and kind of sad. And for the first 15 minutes of her sweeping, we didn't say a word to each other. She's just in there sweeping. And finally, I'm like, this is so awkward. I got to break the silence here. And I said, "Why are you in trouble?" And she stopped sweeping, and she looked at me, and she's like, "It's a long story." And I could just see the sadness in her eyes. And I think she's a 10th grader. And for some reason, she ended up in my room. I never have ever had a detention student end up in my room. And I looked at her and I said, "Well," and I didn't even know her name. And I said, "Well, be careful that when you leave this school, you're not jaded to the things of God. You're not jaded to the things of faith." And I said, "I don't know what's going on in your life, but you feel like right now, I know you feel like this stuff's being shoved down your throat over and over, and you feel like you're being judged, you feel like you're not good enough, whatever the case may be in your life." And she stopped, and with tears in her eyes, she looked at me, because I just called her cards basically. She looked at me and said, "When did you know you were saved?" And I said,
I said, I was born again at the age of 9, and I was baptized. But I had to go and make decisions that would follow me the rest of my life. And I looked at her and I said, fortunately, God is a God who loves to redeem. And I said, he's not too high, he's not too big to redeem you in your situation. And right then and there, we just had this conversation, and I led her to the Lord right there in my classroom with on 30-minute detention or whatever, sweeping my room. And I said, you are born again. You're a child of God. And you may continue to make bad decisions, and you may continue to mess things up, but you're never too far gone that he can't redeem you. And I said, don't let the experiences you have here jade you and turn you off from the love that your Creator has for you. And it was about that time the principal popped back in the room, and she's like, okay, come on. And she left. Because those kind of little appointments, guys, that you can pray for, and he will fulfill, and if you're there, if you're obedient, just ask the Holy Spirit to teach you what to say in those moments, and he will give you the words to say. Let's pray, and then we're going to invite the worship team to come on up, and we're going to do some foot washing up here. So, Father in heaven, I am so grateful that you sent your Son to die. A death that he was undeserving of. That he was our spotless lamb who took away the sins of the world. May we remember that. And may we experience his love. And may we live lives that are worthy of that dying for. May we be people who are bold in sharing that good news with others. May we proclaim your kingship and your kingdom. May it come soon in our days. I thank you for everyone in this room who has come in here in the midst of the heat, on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, they're willing to sit and to worship, to study your word, and allow people to wash their feet. May this time be full of anointing. May your presence be made manifest as we close out this service with just simply being obedient to the words of our rabbi. May your Spirit move amongst us as we worship you this morning. We give you all the glory and all the praise that you deserve. B'Shem Yeshua. Amen. So I want to invite the worship team to come up, and then the elders and deacons as well. I think we have quite a few wash basins up here. So